Friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com worldwide. And I would like, friends, round of applause doesn't work that well on radio, but, our great friend, Loretta Brennan-Glucksmann, would know a bit about radio. I know, Loretta, we'd like to welcome you, first of all, as radio broadcaster with Irish Radio Network, and we were delighted, of course, with that. And the reason that I bring it up first is it's the first thing that comes to mind with Loretta Brennan-Glucksmann hosting today's Irish Today program on Irish Radio Network.
And to my mind too, Adrian, you know how I love that wonderful period. And I cherish every opportunity that you allow me to come back and talk with you and your terrific audience. So this is my pleasure.
Now, so I wanted to get that in, before got on. And I know how much you love when we and just about everybody else thinks that the best thing to do would be, for instance, to list all the awards you've had over the last 40 years.
That's so boring. Please don't do that. Much more interesting things to talk about.
I do want to ask you, though, if you would bring us back to what's almost 30 years ago, and to the establishment of Glucksmann Ireland House at New York University. You and Lou.
Absolutely. That was a happy time in our lives, and actually a fairly happy time in the world. It seems, stuck as we are today, Adrian, it seems difficult to conjure up really happy times when everyone shared in the good times. That seems ancient history, but we will get it back. We will, because we hang in there and we keep trying and we generally succeed. So it was a dream of Lou's and mine, as is obvious. Lou was a very proud Hungarian Jew, and I am a very proud Irish American, and we came together after a result. You and Onya know this story. We had the blind date from hell in, that would have been in about 1983, and we went to the Four Seasons, our mutual friend who was on the Port Authority with Lou, and I was working with public television at the time, and I didn't do anything with finances. It was back in the good old days when that didn't run the news, when the news didn't lead with the S&P report. But so I had no idea who he was. And, of course, at that time he was chairman of Lehman Brothers, a wonderful Wall Street bank, which is unfortunately not in existence anymore. I'm wandering now, so you have to be my editor, as you're so good at, and get me back on track. Anyway, it was a terribly long night, nothing interesting until they offered the cheese and fruit tray, and he picked up a whole apple and started eating it, and there was apple juice dripping down his chin, and the captain was aghast. He said, "Sir, I'll help you with that." And Lou said, munching all the time, he said, "I don't need any help. I can chew an apple." And that, for the first time, I thought, he could have some interesting stuff in there. I'll have to wait and see.
My God.
So that was when the first thing I was interested in, that he had, he was real. So that was Thursday. He phoned me Friday. He said, "That was pretty awful, wasn't it?" I said, "About as bad as I hope it could be." And he said, "Would you give it another try?" And he invited me in the following Tuesday to an opening at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which, unknown to me, Lehman Brothers was sponsoring. It was a Monet exhibit, and it was just sensational. And as we were going up those amazing steps to go in, everybody coming and going was saying, "Hey, Lou, thanks, Lou. Really great stuff." And I thought, interesting, interesting. So we had a wonderful time that night, and we were together from then on till he passed away in 2006. And it's one of the greatest gifts of my life and one of the best gifts that he gave me and our community was we worked on Glucksman Island House. And it became a reality, and all the wonderful people that have gone through it and brought it from one stage to another are still there, and it's gone from strength to strength, and we couldn't be more grateful.
You know, Loretta, as you speak there, I wanted to know at which point, or was there a point when Lou said, "By the way, where did you come from? I mean, you know, where? Allentown, where is that? Pennsylvania?" You had grown up in, you know, with four Irish grandparents, or
absolutely,
and that was indeed. There is another aspect which I would like you at least to refer to, and that is, you had a physical disability in your early youth, mm-hmm. in growing up in Allentown. What was that? What are your memories, longest memories of that?
Very perversely, Adrian, wonderful memories. I was born fairly terribly crippled, actually. My right leg was turned backwards at the hip. It was like a club foot, but it began at the hip. It was very unusual. And in 1938, yes, 38, I'll be 85 in May, and I think that's glorious. In those days, there was not much to be had in the way of pediatric reconstructive surgery. In fact, like zero, especially in Allentown. But my parents, God bless them, they found a man at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital called Dr. John Royal Moore. I can't make that name up. He has to be John Royal Moore. And he was doing groundbreaking work on kids with club feet and similar birth defects. And they took me down, and over the course of 2 years, he reset my entire right leg from the hip down to the foot. And it just was, of course, it was life-altering. But Adrian, my daddy was a postman. During the war, he worked two jobs as a railroad worker in the war effort and his job at the post office. We had no money. Mommy worked at a shirt factory, and I was their first child, and certainly not anything that they had expected to deal with. Monumental costs of surgery. But they did it. And I always thought to myself, it's the first miracle of my life. And I went from a body brace to a leg brace to a cast, full leg cast, and then a cast just from the knee down. By the time I was four, I could walk.
Wow.
And I didn't understand how miraculous it was. It just seemed to me that it was the way my life was going. I knew I was blessed, but I didn't know to the extent. So, of course, I couldn't ride a bicycle or roller skate or anything like that. My paternal grandfather, Daddy's father, Pop-Pop, was father of 18 18 children. My Nana, who was as big as a little sparrow, she gave birth to 18 children, and they all lived. And she raised them all to adulthood. Plus, in her spare time, she took in boarders in Mock Chunk, Pennsylvania, which is now Jim Thorpe, and then they moved to Allentown. What a life. I mean, and it was ordinary. I mean, it was expected. It was certainly not extraordinary. Anyway, it's all by way of saying what a warm and loving and happy childhood I had. And I was so intent on my Irishness because my whole family was intent on their Irishness. Mm-hmm. My mother's family were McHughes, and they had come from Leitrim, from the Arigna Mines, and they all settled in Schuylkill Valley, Pennsylvania, which is around Coaldale, Tamaqua, a little south of Scranton. And so Mommy and Daddy met, and they went to live, after they married, in Allentown with my Brennan grandparents. So I spent a lot of time with my grandfather Brennan, and he was a very wise, amazing man. He worked for the railroad also, and he had the first patent for refrigerated cars. He had no education. He was educated to the sixth grade in Donegal, Ireland. And when the family came over here, education stopped. But he was just intelligent, and he was always, as Nana said, fiddling. He was always working on some gadget or another. But he would spend time with me on the front porch, and he had his big rocker, and he made me a small rocker, and he would teach me a word every day from his big dictionary. And it was my job to learn the word and then to say the word back to him in a story the next day on the porch. So that was the beginning of my love of words and language. So much richness in the face of so much what could be awfulness.
Well, you definitely, it stood to you, and it's nice to know where, you know, the focus on early education, what that would lead to in your life, you know. I know you don't particularly like being listed as a philanthropist, but you have been involved, you know, endeavors for, you know, now close to, you know, for the last coming up 4 decades, and focusing on education and arts and healthcare, but bring you to closer to what is still, you know, an unsettling time, both in the United States and Ireland, and Northern Ireland. And it was not at that point, not just your interest, but the interest of Lou, that despite all the other attractions and distractions along the way, it bugged you and Lou that Northern Ireland, which I really didn't have any, you know, direct ties to, that was something that deserved your attention.
It was like a pebble in your shoe. You couldn't ignore it. You had to do something about it. But you and Onya know this story, Adrian, but when Lou was in the Navy, and he enlisted in the Navy at age 17, and he was assigned to the North Atlantic on a submarine chaser, and they were 2 weeks down and 1 week up. So during his furlough, he always went to Ireland. And he would go where some of his favorite writers had lived and worked. And he came to know Ireland, particularly Northern Ireland, like the back of his hand. I, third-generation Irish-American, had never been and never expected to be able to go to Ireland. It was just not within our ken as the people we were. And when Lou took me to Ireland for the first time, it was beyond Disneyland. It was just so exciting.
Yeah.
And then he wanted to take Mommy and Daddy, and Daddy just was not, he was too fragile. But indeed, Mommy went with us the following day, or the following year, and it was just one of the highlights of my life when we got off the plane at Shannon Airport and we're going outside for grass that you come to before the parking lot. She just quietly knelt down and kissed the ground.
Wow.
And it was just so magnificent and moving, and Lou made that happen. That could never have happened without him. So that was the beginning of our interest in Ireland.
That kind of, destroys the myth that, here you are taking advantage of this wonderful Hungarian Jew,
I would challenge anyone to take him, advantage of Hungarian.
Dragging him into the land of your ancestors.
Absolutely. Yeah. Never happened, Adrian. You knew him well enough to know that never could happen.
His interest
way before I could.
Oh, yes. Indeed. And also, the lead up to, at a time when, establishing an Irish center for Irish studies, that would have been kind of a dream. And as you look back, now coming up to the 30th anniversary, how did, were there many people who felt that, that sounds good, but, it's not going to happen. We've been, up and down that road many times in, following a dream, and then somehow it was not, you couldn't see it through. Were there those in the beginning who said, I don't know, are you sure you want to do this?
There always are, as you know, Adrian, people who say nay before they look at the question. There are wonderful Irish studies programs in both at Notre Dame and in Boston. And Lou was a trustee at NYU, and the president at the time, Jay Oliva, had the great good fortune to have been raised by an Irish mother. And he was very intent on adding an Irish studies program to the six existing ethnic programs that NYU already ran. There was the Spanish, the Jewish, the Greek, and I'm forgetting the others, but there were three or four others, very renowned ethnic studies programs. And Lou and Jay said, what about Irish? So we made a list of the Irish universities and went off. Jay and Mary Ellen, his wife, and Lou and myself, and we spent 10 days in Ireland. And this would have been in late 84, early 85. And our charge was to see if there would be any interest from the Irish universities in establishing any cooperative programs with NYU. Well, was there interest? We were overwhelmed, and particularly we were just absolutely mesmerized and charmed by the Irish people and the Irish educators we met. The first person we met was Ciarán Ó-Hogarty, spelled in the Irish way, and he was president of NUI Galway. We met Ed Walsh from the University of Limerick, with whom we're still involved. We met John's name, the provost of Trinity, wonderful guy who's still doing good work in Ireland. And there's now a woman who's provost of Trinity, and I'm thrilled that she's there. I haven't worked with her yet, but I hope to. So it was an open door when we arrived in Ireland, and everybody said, we're interested. Tell us what you have in mind. Lou and Jay took that back to the board, and Larry Tisch was the chairman of the NYU board at the time. And he had the great good fortune of having an Irish nursemaid when he was growing up. His nurse, when he was a little kid, was, which was typical of the time, an Irish woman. So there were no blockages here, and it just grew like Topsy. Mm. And it's still there today, ready to celebrate 30 fantastic years.
I think, though, that it did help and had to help along the way. I know you've given, you know, a lot of credit to those who were saying, rah, rah, yes, that's a great idea. But to find, you know, a not only a house, but an excellent house with the fabulous address, you know, Washington Mews, and to be able to get a house that on its own just stood out, and to take it from that point, that had to be, you know, a great feather in Lou's cap and yours, in terms of, you know, the what it takes, not just to finance, though obviously that was going to be a massive tab to pick up, but to find a location such as that in the best section of town.
We were able to convince NYU that they needed the Irish studies in their whole portfolio of ethnic studies, and indeed that happened. So that was a great thing. And then, Adrian, do you remember during the run-up to, well, the really early run-up to the Good Friday, mm-hmm. how important Ireland House became for some of those meetings? Remember when we had the, now I'm blocking on the acronym, for the police in Northern Ireland?
Yeah.
And we brought them over, John Timoney, do you remember, who worked
sure,
with
yeah.
Rudy Giuliani in the police, and with Ray Kelly. He brought a few of the policemen from Northern Ireland, and this was dangerous for them. Mm-hmm. They all a couple of them got on a plane. They came to Ireland House. Very quietly, Ray Kelly and John Timoney put together a group of NYPD people, including Kathy O'Toole, who was then still in Boston.
Yeah.
The only woman police commissioner up until that time in Boston. And now they have a woman governor up there, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, anyway, not to mention in a timely fashion, how great is it this week that we have, you know, now a woman, the chief head of the New York City, of the fire department of New York City. And I think on the...
There's a little Irishness in there, Adrian, too.
Sure. But again, just to briefly mention that the police service of Northern Ireland at that time, you know, that was indeed, but the touchy times. And if we were to list, indeed, even give a partial list of the life-changing meetings that took place in Glucksman Ireland House, you know, and many since then, it is, you know, obviously it is the world-renowned Center for Irish Studies, but it also is a home. It's not treated as anything other than a home. And, you know, beautiful brownstone. Again, you know, fabulous address.
Little tiny one, Adrian, but it is wonderful. And we just got through refurbishing it because the roof was leaking. It's 120 years old, that building is. And so finally they put a new roof on it, and the university did. And so we're all spiffed up and ready to have a housewarming, which is coming up in early November. And I will get the information to you so you might give it to your audience.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We'd love to welcome everyone back because COVID shut down everything, and certainly and you.
Sure, it did. And that's a great reopening. I want to bring us to what was really not that well known in many circles, but the American Ireland Fund, and where you reigned, first of all, you are, you know, the chair emeritus of the of the Ireland Fund, the American Ireland Fund, is that again, as I say, you didn't. How did you get into that?
Well, Tony O'Reilly, who was with the magnificent Dan Rooney, the founders of the Ireland Fund 50 years ago. In fact, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary this year in the absolute thick of the Troubles when NORAID was, you know, the most active Irish-American group in America. And Tony and Dan just wanted to offer Irish Americans an alternative, a peaceful alternative to helping their beloved homeland, and to counteract the coffee tins on all the bars in Queens, Manhattan, Brooklyn, everywhere. We tried to fundraise for peaceful activities, and it was, believe me, it was slow starting. Well, I didn't join until it was about, 10 years old probably. And Dan was functioning as, Tony was still chairman when I started. So it was a learning curve for me. But how he pulled it off was he knew that Lou and I were very, very happily married. And he said to Lou, "We would like to honor your wife." Ergo, he had Lou in the palm of his hand. So after they honored me at that first dinner in, I think it was 91 or something like that, very early 90s, and Lou was very taken with the Ireland Fund, and he encouraged me vociferously to be as involved as I'd like to be. And I had retired from my job with PBS because I just couldn't. Being with Lou was a full-time job, and being at PBS was a full-time job. No one should do two full-time jobs. So I wisely gave up PBS, and we had a great almost four decades together until Lou passed. Anyway. I'm wandering because I'm having so much fun thinking about all those good times.
Yeah, you know, but again, to, you know, during and not that it began with that, but during your 20 years of heading the Ireland Funds, the American Ireland Fund, many opportunities came from those who weren't even aware, you know, that there was so much, not just money, but goodwill and interest in America. That this is a, you know, excusing the vernacular, this is a new crowd that showed up that did not feel that the only way to have a resolution in of Northern Ireland, you know, was to take the traditional route, you know, of over
the bomb and the gun. Yeah, the bomb and the gun. Yeah, and we knew there had to be a better way because the Irish people were better than that, and we were Dan and Tony worked very hard and very quietly for many years, and then when Dan was named ambassador to Ireland, he and mm-hmm. Patricia, his magnificent wife, they visited every county in Ireland, and it had such an effect. And Patricia was a teacher, an educator, and she visited so many schools and made such a difference. And the Ireland Fund was able to get equipment into especially rural schools during that time when that wasn't even on their wish list. They didn't even know what to hope for. And the Ireland Fund found these schools, made donations for equipment. It was just in the very early days of computers, laptops, and things, but just gave them another outlet than the sort of anti-Brits and hatred as the jumping-off point for everything. It altered their outlook so often that there was a positive way, and maybe there was an alternative. It was absolutely invigorating and so satisfying. And Lou and I went there and bought a house in Limerick in the late 1980s and became involved with the University of Limerick, which was this upstart in the southern Midlands, sort of. And it was supposed to be a technical school. And Ed Walsh, who was such a visionary, and some of his cohorts weren't ready to settle for that, and Lou loves that, and I'm still working with them. In fact, Adrian, there were just 36 board members of the foundation at the University of Limerick that came out to New York last week,
mm-hmm.
and this was the first time in 3 years we've had our North American meeting, which we used to have every year, and we have a very active chapter of the University of Limerick Foundation here in New York, headed by Dr. Jim McCarron, who is recently retired as head of urology at Weill Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of wonderful people, and it's still going.
Yeah. Loretta, do you want to skip over the part where, you know, your portrait, you know, bigger than life portrait has actually... you know, at the University of Limerick to honor, your contribution mm-hmm. of decades, and Lou, that your portrait is now hanging there. You didn't get a chance to see mm-hmm. that yet, but
no, and that's all right with me. It's just such an awkward experience, Adrian, and the most wonderful thing about it all is that Colin Davidson is one of the best artists in the world. And his paintings, particularly his portraiture, is just untouchable in excellence. Colin is from the North. We've had wonderful conversations. I learned so much from him. So because he did it, I'm very, very grateful and respectful and so grateful to the foundation. But, you know, it's a weird thing to look at yourself up there and you think, what is that about? That's nonsense.
Yeah.
And I'm having trouble making a gracious response to it.
Yeah, okay, well, could you get over it? Because
I'm trying.
It's great. And indeed, you know, you have served or, you know, and continue to serve, you know, on boards just in Ireland alone, the National Gallery of Ireland, Trinity College Dublin, University College Cork, and the Royal Irish Academy. You have been such a tremendous, not only supporter, but you know, you bring and you've done more than your share, you know, in tightening, you know, that link with Ireland and right across the United States. It's also something that required a lot of commitment, and if there's one thing that you have done is you have shown some of us, you know, you were mentioning, you know, octogenarians there, and I stood back from that and I said, no way am I going to follow that in that direction. But you know, in arts and literature, education, you know, again, to bring, you know, to bring all of that and to not only, you know, your own involvement, but you have managed over the years to get a lot of people who normally would not assume that that their interest and input and support would even be, you know, acceptable, much less. But you've done a lot in that area. And,
that's,
you know,
just because they had to know the people, Adrian.
Yeah.
You get the people together, that's when the magic happens.
And yeah.
Getting people to Ireland was my huge crusade. Once they were in that amazing country with the people and the will that those people have, and the deep kindness that sometimes it takes a bit to let it bubble up, but it's there, and people of goodwill see it, and that was what was the most satisfying thing for Lou and me over the years, is just getting people there and letting them see what the Irish truly were, and that's all you need to do.
Again, I'm not going to make a list or even try to all of the philanthropic and support you've had in the arts and education and all of the other areas. But I do want to bring our listeners up to date because the word is that there is a show on Broadway. It's at the Music Box Theater, smack in the middle of Manhattan, and currently, you know, you are a co-producer of the presentation Walking with Ghosts.
It's,
you know,
just phenomenal.
A one-man show of Gabriel Byrne. Now, we know that, Gabriel, first of all, your friendship with Gabriel, and for that matter, there's so many others in the arts and in television and Broadway and in movies taking, you know, for openers, Gabriel Byrne, more than 80 featured movies and more to come.
Yep.
To get his own memoir, Living, from the days in Ireland, from growing up, and, you know, if you want to talk about growing up rough, the humble beginnings of Gabriel Byrne, to be able to bring that, you know, not up, just bring us as far as Hollywood, and then that's another story. That's an amazing feat, and to be able to do this over 2 solid hours. It's brilliant.
It's a tour de force. It really is. I couldn't be happier for a wonderful, deeply kind person than Gabriel. He has worked on this. The book, he and Colin McCann have a saying, because Colin was very, very supportive and helpful to Gabriel when he was first grappling with the book. And Colin always says, the book won't let you write it. You have to fight for the book. It's not like it flows out of you like in the stories. And that's exactly the way it was. And I think it's even particularly more difficult, Adrian, when it's so deeply personal. This, I mean, Gabriel went deep into his memories and to his soul in telling this story. It's deeply personal and deeply sad and deeply happy. Mm. And Gabriel is in a happy place right now. And when we first came to know one another, I'm not sure I ever thought he would have been in a happy place. He was very, very dark. We used to tease him. He's the personification of the dark and brooding artist. Get over yourself. But he really was. But he pulled out of that. He's now in the best time and place of his life. He's married to a fabulous woman, Hannah King. They have an adorable daughter called Maisie, who's now 6, I believe. And Gabriel is fulfilled and happy. I won't say at peace, because then he wouldn't be Gabriel. he still has goals to meet, and he will. But this is so glorious to see him at this wonderful pinnacle of his creative life. And the whole production is produced by Anne Clark, who is about 2'2". She's a dynamo. She's an absolute force of nature, and I'm so grateful to her that she prevailed and brought this amazing piece of theater, Walking with Ghosts, to Broadway. And Adrian, it's the first time there's been an Irish production on Broadway in 16 years.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
I was stunned with that, but Anne has done it. Anne and Gabriel, now on Broadway, the Music Box Theater. It's a phenomenal evening at the theater. I hope everyone has a chance to see it.
Well, again, to watch that performance as we did the other evening, and to see somebody who was able to get that perfect balance. Yes, he had no problem in pointing out his failures, you know, failing as a priest and
exactly.
Funny, recap of his failing as a plumber, you know, and to take that against a backdrop of, you know, how he developed through all the early years, how he developed to be able to take this wildest imagination of somebody like and turn it into somebody. And right through, I think what we learn from is never give up, you know?
No.
And so that rings so true. You know, of somebody who didn't get off, you know, wasn't, you know,
not
a child
easily.
Prodigy.
No.
Yeah.
No, it didn't flow easily. And Adrian, isn't he an amazing mimic? His acting in the comedy bit of imitating his young self.
Yeah.
And imitating his mother. I just was amazed at how adept he is.
Yeah.
At that kind of acting. You never would have seen that in Usual Suspects.
Yeah.
That was dark and brooding, Gabriel. But Walking with Ghosts shows a full panoply of his amazing acting ability. I really hope everyone has a chance to see it. It's just a tour de force.
It is playing, by the way, the friends, as Loretta Brennan-Glucksmann, my guest, has mentioned, at Music Box Theater. That's 45th Street near 8th Avenue. And again, the venue in the heart of Broadway, well worth seeing. And one more time added to the list of great, projects and promotions is we are indeed more than happy friends to have as our guest, as our friend. And I'm not going to get in trouble by not mentioning you know, that in the 257 years history of the St. Patrick's Day Parade in 2018, you became only the fifth woman in all those years to head the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And that's again, we know that that has to be so, so special, despite all the other awards that you have cartloads of them. But that one in particular, I know, meant a lot to you.
It was huge, Adrian, and my daddy was on my shoulder the whole, well, my entire ancestry was on my shoulder all the years. We would listen to it on the radio in Allentown, Daddy and I, and the fact that I was leading the parade up Fifth Avenue, being greeted by the Cardinal, good God, and the topper of the whole amazing experience was that my precious grandson, Liam, who is very, very keen on horses, he loves horses and raises them, he was allowed to sit with the beautiful people from the Horse Carriage Association that had the first carriage. And Liam sat up there very proudly with a wonderful man who is still our friend. And Liam has that memory along with all of us. So that was a highlight. And it's but one of many, one of so, so many, sitting in Ireland House listening to people, to a woman I remember particularly whose husband had just passed. And she was so, she couldn't get, I can't remember what the difficulty was, but she had to wait 2 weeks to get his body back to Ireland.
And yes, indeed.
She came every day to Ireland House, and some of us would drop in and have a cup of tea with her downstairs, and it was her place to wait till she could mourn in Ireland. Things like that you can't make up, nor can you prepare for, Adrian. You don't know that people are going to need that, and how glorious it is to be able to say, please sit with us and have a cup of tea. And that just comes naturally because of the nature of the Irish people. And I couldn't be more grateful for all the experiences and all I've learned. I've learned so much from Ireland and from being with the Irish Americans. I'm deeply grateful.
Loretta, thanks for spending the time with us. And
joy, Adrian.
Again, always a pleasure. Loretta Brennan Fluxman. So long, and God bless. Okay. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, the Flannelly Show, live from New York.